General Brandreel too.
And I found myself on board HMS Javelin. And I was put down underneath in the wardroom and looked after very well. And after 4 hours, we landed at some port in England, which I don't know. There were trains drawn up, and as the trains filled up, and the good ladies of the WRVS handed us cups of tea, we went to our various destinations. And very early in the hours of the next morning, I found myself at, I think, Sedgefield, right up northeast of Darlington. And there was an emergency hospital there. And we soon learned that nearly all the emergency hospitals, to start with anyhow, were certain wards in what we used to call lunatic asylums, where the inmates were moved out and the rest were handed over to the military to run as a military hospital. And I think I spent a month there.
Just before you take it any further, if I could ask you some questions about the Dunkirk period. What did you mean when you said those French soldiers were using the ambulances for fun?
I suppose they'd found these vehicles for fun. They'd found these vehicles lying about, discarded. No doubt some of the ones who brought us up. I think we were in a big convoy. I thought it was 70 or 80, I'm not sure. And they were just running up and down the promenade, driving for fun. They pinched them, so to speak. We also discovered that the guns which had been firing were the defence guns round Dunkirk, which would normally be out facing the North Sea, which had been switched round to prevent the Germans coming into the sort of area. It was long before they'd planned the detailed defence of Dunkirk. But I don't think there were any casualties were inflicted by them, but it gave one the impression that we were really surrounded in all directions, even if we weren't only being fired at by the Germans, we were being fired at, unfortunately, by some French or Belgian troops inadvertently.
Some people seem to think that at Dunkirk there were some British forces acting in a way which can be censured, in that officers were supposed to be pushing their way past the men and not doing their duty to their men and that type of thing. Did you see any bad behaviour?
No, I certainly didn't see that. And I would have thought that in an organised discipline force like a regiment, you would never have found that. It could have been in the other support units as that happened. But I would have said that a platoon officer, for instance, who was commanding the platoon, he would have been jolly careful to see that his men got aboard before he himself did. But nearly all those people were, of course, opposite Bray Dunes. Where we went off on that quay, they'd all been formed up somewhere back in the city, not as units as far as I could see, but just collections of people who got lost or were making their own way. But I didn't see any any signs of officers actually taking the law into their own hands and pushing the others back. I didn't know. Could I see? When it came to the Bray Dunes operation, when the ships came in, my only knowledge of that is what I subsequently saw on films and things. That they were. I was amazed to see how silent and pleased they were. The time I was there, the Germans hadn't bombed them very much. The Germans were going over, and every now and again they did bomb them. But they were very silent and standing very still. There may have been rushes to the boats when the boats came in. Mercifully, the sea was very calm. And, of course, the destroyers and the like couldn't get very far inshore. But I personally didn't see any of that.
Did you see many casualties being taken by our forces, either on the beaches or at sea?
No. Once I was a casualty, of course, I was inside an ambulance and you can't see out of them, or we couldn't then. So what went on all around, no, I saw nothing of that.
What did you see of the readiness of our French and Belgian allies to fight
in
those days?
Well, they came after me because by being wounded, one was ahead of the retreating army. I'd left battalion at Festubert, where they were, I think, for 2 or 3 days. And then they all withdrew on an ordered plan, and they had to wade through certain canals, and they all came back on their feet. plus, I suppose, any vehicles they could have got hold of, but the roads were so chocked. No, I don't imagine they used much in the way of vehicles. And their history, I don't know, beyond the fact that one company, Complete, was captured by the Germans and spent the rest of the war in prison. Others got themselves back into this country, and they all formed themselves. Certain areas were obviously allocated for the divisions as they came back. And the 2nd Division, which we still belong to, all the units of the 2nd Division were sent up to Pudsey in Yorkshire. And again, they were put on, I imagine, football fields or recreational grounds where they were sorted out. And given the new role of defence of this country in the East Riding. And after I'd had my... we were sent on leave after being wounded. And was told to stay on leave till a medical board passed us. But during that time, the battalion was reformed east of Beverley, Hornsey, for the defence of the east coast against German attack. So they reconstituted the division very quickly. I found the life, the life in England was just like peace, was glory of summer. Nobody seemed to be worried, very little was on, and you could have felt that everybody thought, oh, the war's over. And it took people like Montgomery, really, to convince people that this wasn't the case. Anyhow, I started on my leaves seeing friends and relations, and then I got rather bored, so I turned up at the battalion, just outside Hornsey, and resumed my old job of adjutant, despite being posted, I think, to the depot, but the CO and I disregarded that. There was a lot of, I regret to say, disregarding of orders that came from War Office, but I feel it was to the advantage of all of us to be with the people we trained and had fought with rather than being shoved aside in some depot.
Did you see anything of the German Air Force's bombing of Britain in 40-41?
We saw the... of course, during the withdrawal from Pistubert, we literally saw the German Air. We never... As is so often with one's own forward troops, we never saw our own Air Force at all. But I'm quite sure from what I've read after they were there, they had a very big role to fulfill, which was the defence of this country, and they obviously couldn't lose all their planes. But they were, of course, dealing with targets miles behind the German lines. We weren't really equipped to the same extent as the Germans, who were obviously prepared for this war. At Dunkirk, I remember seeing the Germans coming back from a raid, but they didn't pay attention to us. We were certainly not bombed, as far as I know, in crossing the Channel. And after that, we did see quite a lot of bombing, because in our area, there were two big RAF stations. One was Driffield, which was a bomber station. The other was Leckenfield, which was a fighter station. And the Germans would come over from Norway. And I can remember the middle of the day when the CEO was giving out some orders for an exercise. There was a tremendous fight above us with the German bombers being attacked by the RAF. I suppose there were hurricanes in the early days of the war. And we all cheered. Actually, what the casualties were, I don't know, because it fell outside our area. But up to that time, I wasn't, except the spotter planes who spotted where we were, and the mortars or the artillery came on us. I don't remember this, they being attacked by Germans at all, Air Force.
You didn't see anything of the bombing of Hull?
We saw the results, but we were well north from Withensey, I think, up to Hornsey we were. Now, I think that we lived in that time in a period of glorious peacefulness. We used to go and play hockey. There was a certain amount of shooting going on, a certain amount of drink. We were really preparing for something which actually never happened.
The invasion.
Where's the attack, you see, from the east? I'm not quite sure we really ever believed it was going to come from Norway, because our main forces were obviously concentrated in southern England and the southeast. It was obviously from the Channel ports that it was going to occur. But I was posted after about 2 months to the War Office in a training capacity prior to going to the Staff College. And the regiment was still round Hornsey for the next several months. And then the 2nd Division was taken out and sent round the Cape to Burma and fought in that, I think, dreadful war. I always think the conditions of the Burma War was the heat, the Japanese, the jungle. It must have been an absolute hell, even much worse than we went through.
Now, I propose now to, unless you want to say anything about the intervening period, to jump ahead to 44 and the resumption of hostilities on the continent of Europe and how that involved you personally, please.
Yeah, personally. In 44, I found myself in command of a battle school not far from Norfolk Bank. I found myself commanding a battle school at Arundel. This I was very happy to do. We brought one up to date, and we were obviously preparing for invasion of the continent. We saw very little of what actually happened until over the air one morning the BBC announced the invasion had started. I was still at that time commanding the battle school, and I got a signal telling me to move up to London with a view to going over to Normandy. And I arrived in Normandy about 3 weeks after the initial forces. They sorted me out after a bit, and I found myself again with the Dorsets, and this time the 1st Dorsets, who were part of the 50th Division, and they had taken the brunt of the assault. They were a remarkable battalion because they and the 2nd Devons and the 1st Hampshires had all been locked up virtually in Malta and had survived all the destruction that had gone on for years. They'd been pulled out, became part of a brigade called the 231 Malta Brigade, retrained in Egypt, and then they did the assault on Sicily, the assault on Italy, and were back into this country doing the assault on Normandy. So they were pretty experienced, but they suffered very heavy casualties. And I found them in what we used to call the Bocage country, not far from Bayeux. And I took over a company there. And the real fearful thing then was the result of the Germans shelling the enormous number of trees above the hedges, and we were in the ditches round the hedges, and many of our casualties occurred from the explosions from the trees above us. The battalion, having got there on D-Day, we were all there still till about 2 months, when we were preparing for the breakout. I'd become second in command, and I remember we were at near Mount Pinsel, which is just south there, before we got to the Falaise Gap. I think the Falaise Gap is a well-known part where our forces started to develop and go around, making for Paris and Belgium. And we'd had a certain amount of battling with the Germans there. They were obviously on the retreat, and we got more orders to hold on. They pushed through other divisions through us, and we were to come up behind them. And we were getting ourselves ready in broad daylight when suddenly we were bombed, regrettably, by our Allied forces. And this is the thing that did happen. It was jolly hard on a moving target to know who was on which route. We never used the roads. We went across country on tracks we'd made, and it was very difficult for people to know exactly where the front troops were, and I think all armies would have suffered some destruction from their own people. really, as far as I can remember, the only damage done was to blow up nearly all our carriers. We had, I think, 12 of them. These little track vehicles I mentioned earlier. They were all set on fire. Otherwise, I think there were no casualties. But it had forced most of the men into the ditches on the side of the road.
Do you think there's any excuse for it?
Well, they always say that the information passed by our people to the Allied headquarters, giving detail of where the forces were, didn't indicate exactly where our troops were. And these were fighter bombers, not those enormous big ones, so they were flying at a pretty high rate. And although all the vehicles, of course, had that enormous star on them, they aren't always easy to see from above, and they're coming along at 300 miles an hour. It was one of the hazards, I fear, that did happen. I can remember artillery shells falling on us from our own people at some time. But it was really hard to swear that it came from behind, didn't come from a front. No, I think it was right, but we suffered no casualties from those, except from the vehicles. But I think it's a very interesting point. Just after that had occurred, an open car came down the road, a Humber. And in it was Monty. Now, everybody got out of their trenches and out of their ditches and cheered. And I thought, heavens, if there's any proof wanted of the remarkable man who's gone down here, and he had many enemies, I agree. As far as the troops were concerned, he was their man. Well, after that, we joined we used to call it, swanned across North France, virtually freeing all that part of the continent from the Germans. We went very fast. I can't remember the details. I have a map which shows what speed we had run when we arrived at various places. But we got up to Brussels very quickly in September. We were warned that we should find a tremendous ovation in Brussels because they'd only just been evacuated by the Germans. We, as a brigade, were attached to the Guards Armored Division, and we were told to put out markers on various parts of the route to guide our forces in. And I've never seen anything quite so overwhelming. I mean, part of the trouble was that there were virtually no men in Brussels. They'd all been removed by the Germans and sent to concentration camps. And those of us who were in vehicles were absolutely swamped by the Belgian women. They sat on the bonnet, they sat on the back, they gave us cigarettes, they did everything they could. And we did get through Brussels and into the woods on the road to Waterloo, where we encamped, not under fire. How they did it, but various ladies in the area came round with iced cakes and goodies and things to give to us. And we too had by now thought, oh, this is the end of the war. Well, we were only there for 48 hours. When we were told, quick, off to Antwerp. And Antwerp was heavily engaged in warfare, particularly around the docks areas. And we had a bit of a battle there. And then moved on to the Belgian-Dutch frontier, where we halted for a bit, the Leopold Canal, I think it was called. And now it was obvious we were going to prepare for the great attempt by Monty at exercise Operation Market Garden, which was an attempt to land troops all the way along between there and Arnhem, with the airborne corps from this country being brought in, made up, I think it was two American divisions and one of ours, dropping ahead of us when we were to come up on either side of the canal system there, because we were in very flat country, and that was taking part at the end of September, I think. Again, we had tremendous ovation. It was remarkable to see, once you were into Holland, how even the small children could talk to you in English. And what was delightful to us, the numbers of houses in which grew peaches. Now, I've never seen peach growing like apple trees, but they seem to grow all over Holland like that. And we really went on from time to time. But as we moved north, through, I think, a place called Sertogenbosch, we found that we were on a very narrow front. The parachute boys had landed on certain important bridges like Grave, Nijmegen, and Arnhem to secure those. And we were coming up, we were with an armored division, and we would take over from them. And of course, Monty's great idea was we'd sweep round through Arnhem, go east, and we'd cut off the Ruhr. Where we got to that part of Holland between Nijmegen and Arnhem. And that's about as far as we really got, because here was our downfall. It's very flat, very close to the water level, and you found that you were on roads raised above the level of the country. So all the tanks were on a sort of ridge, and they were a sitting target for the Germans. And we got halfway between Nijmegen and Arnhem. We didn't actually know what was happening in Arnhem. Two or three more divisions were brought round on our flank and made various attempts to get across the Rhine to rescue the people in Arnhem. But this is about as far as we got. I think the place was called Elst and Bemmel, and we entrenched ourselves there, and we had a little bit of trench warfare for a bit. And then two things happened. One, we were told that this great division we were, which was the 50th Northumbrian Division, TT, was their sign, they always thought themselves marvellous. They were a very fine division, but they'd been emasculated by the casualties over there, and it was decided that they must come out of the line and go back to England and retrain. I, at the same time, was promoted from second commander of the Dorsets to take over the 2nd Devons. And I was fortunate insofar that of that 50th Division, two battalions were to stay in France and join the 7th Armored Division, i.e. the Desert Rats, which has a well-known reputation, and my battalion and the 9th Durhams. So we withdrew from there, we retrained at a place called Wirt, waiting for the progress over the Rhine and through Germany. Various battles took place over the winter months. It was a very cold winter, snow and everything. There were all sorts of tricks used by the Germans to give the impression they were going to attack us, because we were only just north of the Ardennes. And but the Germans had a considerable success, and we feared that the extension of their movement would come further north towards where we were, and every night we'd have, I suppose, some form of record being played by the Germans through loudspeakers of movement of tanks in all directions. However, nothing came of that, really.
And a kind of deception.
Yes, deception, a very good deception plan. Later on, there was a very big Reichswald battle between there and Nijmegen, which we were not concerned with. The next time we appeared was when the Rhine had been crossed, and we would follow up, and we made a beeline straight for North Germany and Hamburg. We had very little opposition. The air forces had destroyed very many of the villages and towns en route. So there were little pockets of resistance every now and again. But until we got to the canal system, which really operated from the Weser, we didn't really meet serious trouble. By this time, we were still operating with the 7th Armored Division. We had the 11th Armored Division on our left, I think, and the Guards Armored Division on our right. There's a ridge of hills called the Tüteberge-Wald, near a town called Ibbenbüren. And this had presented a problem to the 11th Armored Division. And we were moving up behind them, and I had been instructed to take my battalion and take over from one of the 11th Armored Division so that they could go forward. And I was doing reconnaissance there, and I suddenly received a message to say, go and see one of the battalions, I think it was a Monmouth, who are being surrounded, and see if you can stop the rot. And I got to a canal crossing where there was a bridge intact, and we went over into a farmhouse beneath the Teutoburger Veld, where I found a CO of this battalion. The Germans, they were said to be SS men, had surrounded them. They were finding that their own casualties located in this farmhouse were being made casualties again because the firing of the Germans was virtually non-stopping. I talked to the CIA and we decided very quickly to put some block to stabilize the situation. And then I was told to restore the situation. We had tremendous luck here because the rest of our town was marching down the side of the canal coming south. And there was a broken bridge which we could cross. And we crossed a bridge about a mile and a half north of where this trouble was. And we did a flank attack that afternoon. And I think the remarkable thing was, at the end of it all, we had counted, there were 50 German killed, 102 were captured. And we retook the place, relieved the whole of the invaded battalion, surrounded battalion, and got no casualties ourselves at all. That was a brief period. Having done that, we then moved on, and we came up to the hills above Hamburg. Hamburg has part of it, well, it's in part of it, is Hamburg is, I think, the north side of the Elbe, and just south of it is a big town called Harburg, and we were on the heights of that. This is almost the final act we did in the war. We were obviously preparing for the surrender sooner or later, and we were deployed on the hills. We had another attack against us by the fanatics, which we lost a few people, but it was through the brigade I was with that the German emissaries started to come in. General Waltz, I think, was the name of the German commander of the garrison in Hamburg, and he sent his emissary through, I think it was the Queen's Regiment, which was next door to me. We didn't hear of this until we got news over the BBC. And this was to lead to the final surrender. We were instructed within a few days to move through Harburg, over the bridges of the Rhine, and into Hamburg. And my particular area was that part of Hamburg around the Reichscenter Hamburg, which is our radio station. And it was the radio station that for many, many months we've heard the so-called, this quisling. The Reichscenter Hamburg was the area which Lord Horhor, as he called himself, did all his broadcasting, and we made a beeline for that. He, of course, had got out. In fact, I think he got out to a place called Flensburg, which was in the north part on the way to Denmark. However, we got control of this, and we were deployed in Hamburg for a couple of days. We met a very famous BBC reporter. If I can stop. Now, and when he got home,